Orange Taxi, a new taxi company providing services to the U of I campus and the Champaign-Urbana area 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at 367-8888.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this part of the show, we'll be talking with a scholar who's written quite a lot about the African-American experience in different sorts of ways. His name is Robert Allen, and he is adjunct professor of African-American studies and ethnic studies at UC Berkeley. He has written on a number of subjects. He's looked at social movements, at labor issues, at race and gender. He has done some writing about the experiences of African-Americans in the military in the period of World War II. He's now doing some work on looking at the life of one of the men who was a leader in the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters Union. And he's here in Champaign-Urbana to give a talk about another black scholar, a man named Kenneth Clark. He'll be talking this afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Lucy Ellis Lounge. And this is a talk that's being sponsored by the African-American studies folks here in Champaign-Urbana at the U of I. He's been good enough to come and spend a little time talking with us, and I thought we might ask him to talk a little bit about some of his work that looks at the experiences of black soldiers in World War II. Questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. So locally, 333-9455. I don't know if I said that the first time around, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, good morning. I'm glad to be here.
I'm really pleased. I think that it would be – I'd really like to have you talk a bit about the Port Chicago Mutiny, something that maybe some people – it may be a story some people have not heard, or it may just touch off a faint sort of memory. They might say, oh, yes, I think I've heard something about that, but that I'm not quite sure of the – of the story. And this was something that, despite the name, is happened in California.
That's right, yes.
In Chicago. And it happened in the summer of 1944 at a large munitions depot, which is not very far from San Francisco, where sailors were involved in loading ammunition. And there was an enormous explosion. Several hundred people were killed. Most of them were black sailors. And maybe we'd start there, because I guess it's still something of a mystery what exactly – I mean, we know what happened, but what caused it? Does anybody really know?
No. There was a court of inquiry at the time of the explosion, but they were not able to determine a specific cause. And unfortunately, what the court of inquiry ended up doing was basically laying the blame on the young African-American sailors who were there, who were the folks primarily involved in loading the ammunition onto the ships. It was a segregated Navy base, as they all were at that time during World War II. It was the primary transshipment facility, though, for all of the ammunition and munitions going to our American forces in the Pacific Theater. So it was enormously important. But everyone assigned to loading ammunition there was black, most of them draftees, some enlistees as well. And all the officers were white, and no black person could become an officer. And in fact, there was no other work for blacks to do on the base but load ammunition. So this was the situation there at the time in 1944 when there was this terrible explosion, one of the ships being loaded with ammunition. In fact, it was almost fully loaded. It was something like nearly 5,000 tons of ammunition. Blew up. It was a horrendous explosion. In fact, it would be the most powerful human-made explosion prior to the atomic bomb that would be dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki the following year. 320 men were killed, most of them African-American, because that's who was there loading the bombs. And the base was devastated. The little town of Port Chicago nearby was also heavily damaged. Several hundred people were injured in the town, although no one was injured, killed in the town. It was, in fact, the worst home front disaster during all of World War II. And in the aftermath of this terrible tragedy, what happened is that when the sailors were ordered to go back to work loading ammunition, that was, in effect, a work stoppage, a strike, a protest. But in the military, there's no such thing as a work stoppage, strike, or a protest, and they were in fact charged with and convicted of mutiny, which in time of war is capital offense. 50 of the sailors were charged with mutiny. And this was a tremendous miscarriage of justice, actually, because there was no mutiny. There was basically a protest against the racism and the unsafe conditions at the base. No one had been trained for loading the ammunition. There were no real safety precautions in place. And in fact, many of the officers themselves had never been involved with loading ammunition before either. So as one of my informants told me, this was an accident waiting to happen.
Mm-hmm. How organized was this protest? That is the effort of the sailors to say, essentially, look, this incredible disaster happened before. Here, it's just another disaster waiting to happen again. It's not safe. We feel that we should not be asked to do this dangerous work, at least not on the present conditions. How organized was the protest?
Well, there was some men who were very clear about the conditions there and that this was unacceptable. In fact, one of the men told me that in the weeks prior to the explosion, he had gone to his commanding officer several times and said, the way we're working here, there's going to be an explosion. Something terrible is going to happen. And the officer basically shrugged it off with the explanation that, well, the bombs can't explode because there are no detonators in the bomb, so there can't be an explosion, which turned out, of course, not to be true. But in the aftermath of this tragedy, and keep in mind when I say the men who were here, most of them were teenagers, 17, 18, 19. The man who was accused of being the ringleader of the mutiny was 22 years old. So we're talking basically about very young teenagers. There was discussion among the men after the tragedy, of course, because so many it was a traumatic experience. They lost so many of their friends in the terrible explosion. But there was no concerted effort to organize a protest or to get the men to refuse to go back to work. In fact, some of the men who engaged in the work refusal had not been involved in any of these other conversations. Some of the men who were, in fact, accused of mutiny had not even been directly involved in the protest itself. But they were singled out and put on trial for mutiny and convicted and given long prison sentences as a result of this.
I came across a story. This was from a couple of years ago that actually was an obituary about one of the last survivors, one of the last men who had been convicted as part of this, and who, in fact, near the end of his life in 1999 was actually pardoned by President Clinton. One of the things that strikes me about the story that it tells about him, this man, Freddie Meeks, was that he apparently afterward hadn't told anybody that he had been involved in it. What this says was that apparently he told his wife, but for almost 50 years, he never told his children. He didn't tell any of his employers. So it sounds as if this was a great sort of weight, the stigma that the men had carried with them afterwards. Was that story repeated with other men?
Yes. Several of the men told me that they had never mentioned this to their families. In fact, one of the men I went to interview in New York, he was one of the first with whom I spoke. When I showed up at his home, and we had corresponded, we talked on the phone, and he'd agreed to this interview, and so I showed up at his front door. But instead of inviting me into the house, he stepped outside and said he wanted to go down the street and we'd talk at a neighbor's house. So, of course, I said, fine, if that works for you, it works for me. But at the end of the conversation, I asked him, I said, I hope I didn't cause a problem for you or any inconvenience by coming to your home to do the interview today. And he said, well, no. But my son, I have a 21-year-old son, he said, he was home today. I have never told him what happened to me at Port Chicago, and I wasn't sure that I wanted him to know even today. So I didn't want to invite you in. I'm sorry to say I could not invite you in because I would have had to introduce you and say why you were there and so on. So that's why we're doing the interview here. And it just shocked me because I realized that all these years, decades later, some of these men were still traumatized by this event that had happened so many years ago. It was still very much a part of their consciousness to the extent that they still hadn't discussed it with our families. And for a moment, I almost thought I shouldn't be doing this. What right did I have to come along all these years later and dredge up these painful memories for these men? But I decided to continue with the research process because I realized in my research in the documentary record that their stories, their voices were not in the documentary record. And if we wanted to know the full story of what had happened at Port Chicago, I needed to interview these men. And that was basically what I said to them. I said, I wanted to tell the whole story here, and I need to know how you experienced this because it's not in the record. Part of the reason it was not in the record was that at the time of the mutiny trial, the court, and this was a military court, ruled that any discussion of events prior to the explosion itself was irrelevant. And so the men's experiences there with the unsafe working conditions, being forced to race against each other and loading ammunition and so on, could not be discussed and is not in the record.
Well, according to this same story, there was about 10 years ago, I think, the Navy reviewed the convictions and they actually upheld them, claiming, first of all, that race was not a factor in the verdict. But apparently it found that maybe it had been some way, it grudgingly seemed to acknowledge that it had made mistakes in assigning the men to do this work. Clearly, this was at a time when black soldiers were still doing things like driving trucks, and they were support workers, and they weren't allowed on the front lines of combat. I don't think. At least
reluctantly late in the war, some were.
Yeah. And
I think grudging is the right word here because they did admit reluctantly, grudgingly, that there was discrimination, there was racism at the base at the time. And that was true for other bases as well. I mean, it wasn't unique to Port Chicago. That was the general policy in the U.S. military at the time. But they claimed that there was no discrimination, there was no racism involved in the court-martial itself, which just doesn't make any sense. It's not true. What we were trying to do at that point in 1994 was to seek to get the convictions overturned on the grounds that it was not a mutiny. There was a work stoppage, but it was a protest against the unsafe conditions there and the racial discrimination. It was not a mutiny because a mutiny is an attempt to usurp or to take command in the popular mind, is a seize control of the base or of the ship. That was never what these men attempted to do. It was basically a peaceful sit-down protest against the discrimination and the conditions there at the base, which were horrendous. As I said, no training, the racial discrimination, the work divisions being forced to race against each other and loading bombs. This is insane. So it's not surprising that they were upset by this. And their worst fears were confirmed when the explosion occurred after the officers were said that it's impossible, the bombs don't have detonators.
Mm-hmm. Is there any parallel can you draw between these men and the conditions under which they were working and white soldiers and sailors that would have said that this was a case of disregard that had something to do with the fact that they were black? Or was it not? Would there have been that kind of disregard for the safety of any soldier or sailor someplace else? That it was just people said, "Oh, it was wartime, and certainly this work is dangerous, but it's war, and you do face dangers, and you just get on with what you do. You do what you're ordered to do."
Well, I mean, it certainly was wartime, and the men were expecting to face danger. In fact, many of them had volunteered to come into to serve. They came in with the expectation they were going to be fighting, they were going to be serving their country. And the experience, though, of being assigned to this kind of duty was a humiliating experience because only black men were assigned to do this work. So clearly that was the racial discrimination there. Many of them had been trained for other kinds of work, gunner's mate, radio operators, and so on. And they hoped to be on the ships overseas fighting for their country. And instead they were relegated basically to being stevedores without even the training that was necessary to do that job. So there was definitely a racial component to this. And in a way, it's almost as though these men were considered expendable, that their lives were less valued than the lives of white sailors. I think that was the message here. And the fact that they could not work in other capacities, even on the base, tells you something then about the nature of the discrimination that they faced. So I think it is true that there was a racial component to it, that black lives were not as valued as white lives were, and that black men were put in situations where they were expected to do work without any training at all in a very dangerous situation.
Mm-hmm. So I'm assuming that the other, at this time, this was in 1999, I talked about the fact that this, I read an obituary of this one man who was pardoned by the president. At the time, I think this article says there were just three men.
Just three survivors at that point.
And I'm assuming that they all were pardoned.
No,
they were not.
Only the one, Freddie Meeks. Because the way the pardon process works is you have to apply for the pardon, and which means you have to be alive to apply for it. So this is the problem then that we are facing now in terms of trying to get the convictions overturned. Because although the men who were involved in this are now deceased, their families are very much concerned about it. Because as the families have come to learn the truth of what happened there, they would like to see their fathers, brothers, husbands, the men who were there, who were convicted unjustly in this manner, they would like to have the record set straight so their names can be cleared. That's important to the families. And that will take some sort of action, probably in effect an act of Congress, to get those convictions overturned because the Navy has refused to do so. Absolutely. That's what happened in 1994. When the Navy admitted that there was racial discrimination, but said not in the trial, and therefore we're not going to overturn the convictions. Mm.
I understand there's some kind of memorial there. What is it you see if you go there?
Yes. At the time of the 50th anniversary, there was a memorial established there, which is a series of plaques at the site of the blast itself. And you can see the remnants of the old pier that was there where the two ships were tied up when the explosion occurred. And there's an effort now to make that a permanent memorial, though, because the base itself may be closed, and if that happens, then what will happen to the memorial? So we're trying to get the memorial established as a permanent facility that would be under the control of the National Park Service.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Robert Allen. He is adjunct professor of African American Studies and Ethnic Studies at the University of California at Berkeley. And if you're interested, by the way, in reading some more on this story, he's authored a book on it, which is titled The Port Chicago Mutiny. It came out in 1989. And if you're interested in reading the book, you can certainly seek it out. Questions, of course, are welcome. Questions, comments, too, as we continue our conversation. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I thought it'd be interesting also to have you talk about the subject of another book that you have written that is also about the experiences of African Americans World War II. And this is a book about the experiences of one man, Eddie Carter, who was one of those who finally was given the opportunity to get involved in the front lines of combat and served, I believe, under General Patton.
That's right.
Served honorably, heroically, was decorated, and yet apparently there are a lot of people who felt that he arguably should have received the Congressional Medal of Honor, the top honor that we have, and that he was denied that. And in fact, none of the medals, none of the Congressional Medal of Honors that were given out in World War II, none of them went to African American soldiers.
Not one. Yes, and African Americans had won the Medal of Honor in every other U.S. conflict. So it's very odd, to say the least, that none won this during World War II. But Sergeant Edward Carter, volunteered to go into the service, as did thousands of others at this time, to serve the country. And was put into one of the segregated trucking divisions. Most of the black men and women who served in the military were assigned to these service units, trucking, stevedoring, cooks, helpers of various kinds and so on, not to combat duty. And although Sergeant Carter himself had actually served in combat, interestingly enough, he had been in China at the time of the Japanese invasion and had fought the Japanese. He was in Spain at the time of the Spanish Civil War, and he fought against the fascists there. So interestingly enough, he had combat duty in two of the wars leading up to World War II, but the U.S. Army didn't consider him adequate for combat duty. Nevertheless, when he, at the time of his being shipped overseas with the service unit, this coincided with the Battle of the Bulge, which was the great German counteroffensive there, which threatened the U.S. advance. And in the wake of the devastating counteroffensive, which the Americans managed to turn back, there was a huge need for replacements, of which there was a lack of replacements. So for the first time, black soldiers were allowed to volunteer to serve in combat units. This is how Sergeant Carter got into the war. Although interestingly enough, in order to serve in a combat unit, he was stripped of his rank as a sergeant because the military didn't want any black man to have a rank that might put him above a white, have him commanding white troops. Mm-hmm. So he was stripped to private. But in the course of the war, he served in General Patton's 3rd Army, which was advancing on the Rhine. And in that advance, the column was stopped by a German artillery. And Sergeant Carter volunteered to take a squad of men to reconnoiter the situation. In the course of this, the two men who were with him were killed. He continued to advance. Wiped out a German machine gun nest, one of the artillery positions, fought himself basically single-handed all day long, was wounded several times, and managed to return to the American lines with two prisoners who also were able to tell the American forces about the location of the German positions up ahead and helped to secure Sergeant Carter's action helped to secure the advance of the American units in this campaign. So it was a heroic action, most definitely, and I think anyone else would have been awarded the Medal of Honor, but he was awarded the Distinguished Service Cross, which is an honor, but it's second rank compared to the Medal of Honor. And no black soldier was awarded the Medal of Honor during World War II. But in the years subsequent to this, and long after Sergeant Carter's death in 1963, the Army, basically under pressure from civil rights groups and the media and other concerned citizens, went back and looked at the records again and determined that they would award the Medal of Honor posthumously to 7 African-Americans who served in World War II, one of whom was Sergeant Carter. Mm. So in the end, justice was done there, but of course it was too late for Sergeant Carter, although important, very important for his family and for the community as well, mm-hmm. to have these men finally recognized as the heroes that they were.
Well, and this also was during the Clinton administration. Did the president have something to do with this?
Actually, he did. The president was involved. In fact, the families got to meet President Clinton at the time of the ceremony. And he was very much supportive of this, of getting the Medal of Honor for these men.
Well, again, if you would like to read this story, also our guest, Robert Allen, has written a book on this. It is a little bit more recent than the book on the Port Chicago Mutiny. This is a book. It's titled Honoring Sergeant Carter, Redeeming a Black World War II Hero's Legacy. It was published by Amistad HarperCollins in 2003. So I'm sure that you go out and find that book again if you'd like to read that story. We have a couple of callers here who would like to be a part of the conversation, and we can do that very easily, starting with someone in listening this morning in Indiana, and I believe that's on line 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Two questions. I'm sort of finding this is almost incredible. It takes me back to an introductory sociology course where a teacher gave an outline of a man's education and that he was a Harvard grad, blah, 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 and all that kind of stuff, talked about his work in school, and asked the class, what kind of job he would get. And he said, oh, yeah, I want to tell you, he's black. Mm-hmm. And, of course, that turned the whole thing upside down, and I just, I was following you through this, taking these two guys through all this combat stuff and doing all the things. I mean, that's TV stuff there almost, And he comes back, and he doesn't get the medal that he should. It took me back to that real fast. Second question, do we know the names of the people above those fellows at Port Arthur who made the decisions that only blacks are going to be carrying this stuff? Presumably it's not dangerous because it doesn't have detonators. I think I can certainly emotionalize about that. If I were in a place that blew up and somebody I had known that there were no detonators, I would start distrusting anybody above me about what was going on. I just wondered if we, through the investigations, those common, whoever they are, the ones that made the decisions for all this, is that on the public record also? I was wondering about that.
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and the thing about the more or less the Navy saying, yeah, everything happened that way, but we're not lifting the mutiny thing. I just you know, that's surely prima facie is racist, so no doubt about that. Thanks for your work. Next thing, I have in my mind, I don't know if it's true or not, wasn't the first group that went into Dachau, I think, or one of the concentration camps at Black?
That's
group?
Right. It was that's a Black right. Tank Division, the 761st Tank Division, which was an all-Black group because even when Blacks got into combat, they were often in these segregated units. And, they were the liberators of one of the concentration
that's
camps. Right.
That was very ironic, you know, in the history of how
quite
things
so, happened. Quite so, yeah.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you for calling.
Do you want to talk a little bit about the first question the caller asked about the people who were in command?
In command, yes. Well, we certainly know the names of the local commanders and so on, and but I don't think it's so much a question of whether they were personally racist or this was the policy of the Navy at the highest levels. And it was the national policy of the military as a whole. In fact, in 1941, A. Philip Randolph, the great Black labor leader, confronted President Roosevelt, saying that, "Mr. President, here we are in a war against fascism and racism abroad, but our own military is racially segregated. This is a contradiction, Mr. President. You need to do something about it." And out of that confrontation, President Roosevelt issued an executive order, number 8802, which did, in fact, desegregate. It didn't desegregate the military, but at least took a step and desegregated the defense plants, which was an important thing because it opened up jobs for Black workers then to serve in the defense plants, to work in the defense plants as well. But that's, I think that tells you right there that this was not so much a question of what the commanders at the local level were doing or thinking, but we're looking at a national policy that needed to be changed at the highest levels. And eventually, 1948, President Truman did issue an order desegregating the military. But one of the things I discovered is that that Port Chicago, the work stoppage there, played a role in this process, because in the aftermath of the terrible explosion and then the so-called mutiny, as the word got out that these were all Blacks who were serving there and all Blacks who were now being charged with mutiny, there was an expression of outrage from many public sectors, civil rights groups, civil liberties groups, some unions and so on, who protested and said, this is unjust. How can this be allowed to go on? And the Navy, feeling this pressure, actually began the process of desegregation, first at Port Chicago, bringing in, for the first time, white sailors to work also on loading ammunition. And then over the next year or two, they began desegregating their training facilities and finally the ships themselves. And so that by 1946, the Navy was already in the process of desegregation 2 years before Truman issued his order. And my research revealed that that was a direct result of the pressure that was generated by public response to the explosion, the tragedy there, and then these men being put on trial for mutiny. So ironically, although the men, we can say that they're, if you're going to call it a strike, their strike failed in the sense that they didn't accomplish what anything at that point, and they ended up themselves being put in jail as mutineers. Yet the long-term effect was to precipitate the process of desegregation in the Navy.
Mm-hmm. Although I think, as I remember this story, while what you say is true about Harry Truman being the one who finally signed the piece of paper that officially said desegregated the military, that there was a lot of resistance and that it did not proceed easily or immediately. It took a long time.
It did. And what I saw in the research, again, some ironic things here, is that within the Navy, within the military itself, there were differing positions on what to do about the question of race discrimination and so on. And some folks, whom we might refer to as the liberals, were in favor of general desegregation, including Secretary of Navy Forrestal, who believed that, yes, we're in a democratic nation, we should not have this kind of thing, and certainly not in our own military. But the conservatives were very much committed to segregation forever kind of philosophy. But ironically, in the wake of this, the tragedy and then the so-called mutiny, for the liberals, that was more evidence that we need to desegregate. But for the conservatives, interestingly enough, they decided, well, actually, what we need to do is to disperse these Black sailors here, because if we group them together like this, they're going to make trouble. And they're going to revolt. They're going to be trouble for us. So we're in favor for dispersing them. So ironically, the two sides could, at this point, agree. For the liberals, it was desegregation. For the conservatives, it was dispersal.
We're a little bit past our midpoint here. Again, I'd like to introduce our guest, Robert Allen. He is adjunct professor of African American Studies and Ethnic Studies at University of California, Berkeley. And I do also want to mention these two books once again, because if you're interested in reading these stories in a little greater depth, you can seek them out. One is The Port Chicago Mutiny. That was published in 1989. And then the other, Honoring Sergeant Carter, that was published in 2003. We have another caller, a couple callers to talk with. Let's do that. Next is line one in Champaign. Hello.
Yes, Professor Allen. I have done research in this area of ending discrimination in the uniformed military services. One point I'd like to make is I am very much interested in reading your books, but I read a book that was very provocative entitled Blood for Dignity. I cannot recall the author at this time. I'm on a cell phone. But basically, African Americans wanted to fight. Mm-hmm. To shed their blood to obtain some dignity as first-class citizens in the United States. That's always been the patriotic stance of African Americans.
Yes.
And the group that was focused upon in this book was a group of African Americans who, because of military necessity, were given a chance to fight in the German counteroffensive, the Battle of the Bulge, which I think you alluded to, one specific African American.
Yes.
They fought bravely. Everyone admitted that they fought with a tenacity unheard of, unseen before. Even Germans who fought against them commented on the tenacity of the fighting of African Americans. I do believe this unit or one unit offshoot may have freed their cow, but that was sort of covered because they did not want that to be known in the United States that an African-American unit had liberated their cow, which I find very ironic, but that's, I guess, the nature of the racism that existed back there. The part that I found very difficult and the men found very difficult, that after the war ended in World War II and they were in turn ready to go back to the United States, they were re-put in resegregated units, put back in their transportation units, and were not allowed to march in New York City along with the whites they had fought alongside because they reverted back to the situation before they were integrated into combat units, which caused a lot of bitterness to be engendered in these African-American soldiers. After reading that book and looking at how they wanted to fight for dignity, I really felt very much sorry for them. So I just wanted to share that aspect of this struggle for equality within the armed services and how blacks have looked at it as a form of obtaining dignity as first-class American citizens.
Yes, that's a very important point, and thank you for bringing that up. And as a matter of fact, the men I interviewed for the book, a number of them told me, those who volunteered, that this was their primary motive for volunteering, is that they felt that by serving honorably in the military, fighting for their country, that this would help the process of achieving full civil and human rights for African Americans. And it was hugely discouraging and led many of them to despair to see that even where they made some progress in the military, as happened, as you point out, with that group of, I think there were 2,200 men at the time of the Battle of the Bulge who were then recruited and served in the fight against the Germans,
right,
and who served very honorably and courageously. And then after that, to be returned to these segregated units, or after leaving the military, to return to segregated life in the United States and to see that things had not changed, that was very discouraging. But one of the things we can say is that many of the men who did come out of that experience did, in fact, help to get the civil rights movement going in this country. And so out of that despair and discouragement, there did come something that was, I think, helpful to the struggle, their involvement in the fight for justice and for civil rights.
Okay. And one other point is that even though President Truman issued his executive order 9981, calling for the end of discrimination or the end of unequal treatment, some Southern generals argued this only meant separate but equal.
Yes.
Eventually, Truman said it meant desegregation. Blacks were not fully integrated into combat units until, as a matter of military necessity, not policy,
mm-hmm,
into Korea.
Yes, that's true.
Once again, a need to have soldiers led the United States military to accept blacks and allow them to shed their blood for the dignity of being first-rate, first-class American citizens.
That's very true, and it says something about the power of racism in our country that changes were not made in the interest of justice or even in the name of humanity, but as a matter of military necessity. And that this is what led to the changes. And when that necessity was no longer there, then things often simply reverted to the old practices.
Absolutely, sir. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Well,
thank you for calling.
For the call. We'll continue here and talk next with a listener in Chicago on line 4.
Yeah, hi.
Mm-hmm.
I tuned in late just about 5, maybe 10 minutes ago, and I may be off the mark, and I haven't heard the full program, but when I heard you mention racism in the Navy, I thought I'd offer this bit of knowledge, even though it may be a little bit off the point. I think it's vital. The officer corps, prior to 1948, and probably even still to a lesser extent, was made up mainly of Southerners. The Navy more so than the Army. The people who went to the Naval Academy and to the Military Academy in West Point were selected from the pillars of society in practically all cases. In the South, the pillars... where you had families who owned property and that sort of thing, property rather than being having property broken up, the one son was given, and most of the families was given the property, willed the property, and the other sons had to fend for themselves. Well, the best place to go was into the military, so that this is how the military became overpopulated beyond their normal rate in the United States with Southern gentlemen, and most of these Southerners were committed to segregation, and this is why segregation held on so long in the military, particularly in the Navy, but less so in the Army, and why you have it even now hanging on to a certain extent, although. The military is probably less segregated than the general population in the United States.
Well, I think that's a factor, sort of the Southern factor here. But I don't think that entirely explains it, though.
No, because... I'm not saying it entirely, but it's a good percentage of the reason.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. But at Port Chicago, which is located in California, the interesting thing to me there is that a number of the sailors told me that the first time they experienced racial segregation was, in fact, in the U.S. Navy at Port Chicago. That the segregation there was the policy, despite the fact that in California there was no general policy of racial segregation, but it was introduced by the Navy itself. And ironically, the one Southerner I know who was involved in that story was the defense attorney who tried to defend the men against the charges of mutiny. So I think that what you're saying, you know, there's certainly an important point there, but I think by this point in the nation's history, it had really become national policy, and so the federal government here, I think, has to bear some responsibility for what was happening.
Yeah. By the way, as an aside, I was drafted into the Army April 12th, 1946. Right after I had turned 18, and this was the first anniversary of Roosevelt's death.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm from New Jersey. I was, and 8 o'clock in the morning, we would bust into the Jersey City Armory, where we stayed all day until about 8 o'clock, mm-hmm. doing nothing. There were no whites at all in the group that I was in the Armory when I was there, or at least not visibly anyhow.
Mm-hmm.
We were trained down to Fort Dix, got there about 10 o'clock. No blacks at all. Only one black after they dismissed us at about 1:30 in the morning. There was one black that came into the into our barracks. He was the last guy in, and he was the only black I saw in all my time at Fort Dix.
Mm-hmm.
Even though, well, Jersey City and my hometown, Bayonne, had a very small black population, maybe 1-2% or thereabouts in Bayonne, maybe a little larger in Jersey City. But the rest of New Jersey was more highly populated with blacks. And so it was a peculiar picture. And then I was put into the Air Corps, and I saw no blacks at all when I was all in the Air Corps at all.
Well, thank you very much for calling in with that information. We appreciate it.
All right. Let's go to another caller here as we're getting short on time in this hour. We'll go next back here locally to Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yeah. Have you done any study of African-Americans in academe?
Yes.
And what's the – because I used to teach in Chicago at a university, and I had a fair percentage of African-Americans. And it seems to be for them – to get ahead in academe is difficult at times. Is that true? Or
that's certainly true. I think the public institutions are somewhat more responsive, but even there are big problems. I teach at the University of California at Berkeley, and there what we're seeing is that, interestingly enough, the student population is becoming increasingly students of color. In fact, now it's probably pretty much a slight majority. And the graduate students are we're getting more and more graduate students of color as well, but the ranks of the faculty remain pretty much a bastion of whiteness, and particularly white men. And the tenure process, the way that this is organized really works against, I think, the prospects of real desegregation. And I think this is true not only at Berkeley, but at many other universities as well. So you're right. This remains a huge problem in our society, because these educational institutions should be, I think, reflective of the populations that they're serving. And while we're making some progress there, but not without some big setbacks, too, in terms of desegregating the student population, the ranks of the faculty still remain pretty much segregated.
Well, the other one is that with this trend of less tenured positions across the board, and in some places, what is it, up to maybe 50% adjunct faculty or part-time faculty and all that, even makes the situation worse.
Yes. Well, ironically, I'm an adjunct myself, so quite familiar with that. But, yeah, at a number of institutions where there is some where you see more people of color in the ranks of the lecturers, whose employment situation is very precarious, and of course they make have a higher teaching load and lower faculty, lower pay than regular faculty. And then, as you point out, in the adjunct, the ranks of the adjunct faculty. But and this is something that really must change. But the way it is changing, as you point out, in terms of bringing people in at these adjunct and lecturer ranks, means that a lot of the burden of teaching is being shifted to these folks, but the benefits and the salary they are not seeing.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for your comment.
Right, thank you. Let's go to someone else. This is Champagne, line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I wondered how many of the people, the black community that did get to serve in Europe, got to have the GI Bill. I wonder if they were able to take advantage of that bill, and to what extent those people then could turn around and get jobs after they did get their degree.
I don't have any figures on that. Some were able to take advantage of the GI Bill, but the anecdotal evidence I have is that many were not. And that things that helped other men coming out of the service, like small business loans and so on, generally African Americans were not could not avail themselves of these opportunities. The educational opportunities, some were able to take advantage of that. But again, because of the continuing discrimination in the general society, even where they were able to take advantage of the GI Bill, they were not necessarily able to convert that then into a better life for themselves.
Yes, I'm familiar with one situation like that, and it was very difficult for that person to get a job.
Yes,
even degreed. So thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
We're down here to maybe we have about 5 minutes left, and there are many other things that we could talk about. I would be interested in having you talk just a little bit about C.L. Dellums. This is a man who was involved in leading the union of sleeping car porters, which I think is a really – it's an interesting story. It's certainly an interesting piece of American labor history, but I think it's a great story in and of itself, how the lives of those men – what they did, how they organized, and so forth.
It's really an amazing story because these men were what were called Pullman porters. They worked on the sleeping cars, which were so important in terms of the national transportation system, people traveling back and forth from city to city and across the continent. In order to do that comfortably, you had these sleeping cars operated by the Pullman Company. And the man who operated that company, George Pullman, decided that the best people to work on those in terms of servants and the porters and so on were black men. He hired only, almost exclusively, black men in those positions. So it was a segregated job, low-paying job, very little benefits, long hours and so on, until they began organizing the union in 1925 and succeeded in doing so. And it became the first all-black, well, not the first all-black union, but the first nationally organized all-black labor union. And it had a tremendous importance for labor history in this country because they also, once they organized the union successfully, they began pushing for desegregation in the AFL-CIO, where many unions were segregated or didn't allow blacks at all. And they also, the union also became very much involved in the civil rights struggle. Mr. Dellums was one of those who did so. Because if you stop and think about it, if you've got a group of men traveling back and forth across the country every day, that's sort of a natural communication network. And also, if these men are experienced in organizing a trade union, which is a very difficult work, that experience could also be transferred to the civil rights struggle. So a number of these men, including Mr. Dellums and others, particularly in the South, played an important leadership role in the development of the civil rights movement in the 1950s and 1960s. So the union had influence far beyond just the labor movement itself. It had an enormous influence far beyond its numbers, which are only about 12,000, in our society as a whole because it provided leadership for the struggle for civil rights and human rights. And as I pointed out in the example with Mr. Randolph confronting Mr. Roosevelt, President Roosevelt, it also affected national policy because that desegregation order issued by Roosevelt opened up tens of thousands of jobs to African American workers, to women workers, to other workers of color. It was something that was hugely beneficial to our society. And it's amazing that this one union of 10 or 12,000 men was able to accomplish these kinds of things, but it certainly did.
Yeah, and Philip Randolph was the, in case anybody's not sure, he was the head of the
He was the head of,
head
the,
of
un-
the union.
Union. Yeah.
And he was the man who, as you say, went to Franklin Roosevelt and said, look, you've got to do something about the issue of segregation in the military. So that says something about the significance of his political position, the fact that he was at least in a position to talk to the president and to deliver that kind of message.
Right. And I think the president listened to him because he realized he had successfully organized this powerful union, which had confronted a very powerful corporation. And compelled them to negotiate. So when A. Philip Randolph said that he could bring 10,000, 100,000 people to Washington to protest, I think Mr. Roosevelt took that seriously. Mm-hmm. And, you know, interestingly enough, years later, 1963, it was A. Philip Randolph who was one of the organizers of the Great Civil Rights March on Washington in 1963. So even though it was called off in 1941, they brought it off in 63.
Yeah. We're just about at the point we're going to have to stop. I know that you're here to talk about Kenneth Clark. Do you want to say just something about
Well, this is the 40th anniversary of the publication of his classic book, Dark Ghetto, which is one of the first studies of African-American, the plight of African-American communities looked at from the standpoint of these communities as being like colonies, internal colonies, domestic colonies in the United States. And that's the metaphor that he uses in describing the dark ghetto. He says that these are like educational, social, economic colonies, and they suffered basically underdevelopment, as in the way colonies in the third world have been underdeveloped. So it was a very powerful analogy that he used there, and it got a lot of people starting to think, myself included, about this notion of internal colonialism, a domestic colonialism, which affects not only African Americans, but if you think about it, Native Americans, Chicanos in barrios, and Asian Americans too. I mean, what are Chinatowns and Japantowns if not simply internal colonies?
Well, we're going to have to stop. By the way, our guest for this morning, Dr. Robert Allen, will be talking about this very subject that he just touched on here. He's here visiting the campus. This is a visit sponsored by the Afro-American Studies and Research Program. He'll be giving this talk or participating in a panel discussion on this work of Kenneth Clark this afternoon at 4 o'clock in Lucy Ellis Lounge. So I assume anyone who was interested in attending should stop by. Also, our guest, Robert Allen, has authored a number of books, and if you're interested in reading some more about the experience of African Americans in service in World War II, you might look for the two books that we have mentioned, The Port Chicago Mutiny, that was published in 1989, and more recently, Honoring Sergeant Carter, Redeeming a Black World War II Hero's Legacy, that was published in 2003. Our guest, Robert Allen, is Adjunct Professor of African American Studies and Ethnic Studies at University of California, Berkeley. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. Programming here on AM 580 is made possible in part by a grant from the Thrifty Nichols American Classifieds, distributed each Thursday in over 100 towns in East Central Illinois, on the web at AmericanClassifieds.com. The programming is also made possible today by a grant from the Living Yoga Center in downtown Champaign, offering a variety of classes designed to help students bring balance into their lives by finding strength and serenity through the practice of yoga. Classes are ongoing. Individuals can start anytime. For more information, call 384-5829 or visit their website at www.livingyogacenter.net. But later on today, as part of the afternoon magazine, Celeste Quinn will be talking with journalist Harold Evans, author of a new book titled They Made America: From the Steam Engine to the Search Engine, Two Centuries of Innovators. That's coming up today at 1 o'clock. In the next hour of this show, we will have another conversation about Social Security. Our guest will be Mark Weisbrot. He's an economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. So I hope you'll stick around. Coming up next, we'll have news at 1 minute past the hour, and before that, an update on the markets.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate, operating, and machinery.